listening to Wake Up.
Wake up, Hollywood. This is your host of the most, Nikki Carulla. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have writer, producer, director, Lisa Klein with us today. Say hello, Lisa.
Hello.
It's good to see you. The last time I saw you, we were eating with your husband, Doug, and now Oscar winners, Doug and Karthike for Elephant Whispers. And you told me about this movie that we're going to talk about today. And I got to tell you, I was not prepared for how incredibly insightful, deep, beautiful of a movie it was, because it really, I mean, I just sat there and just, you feel all the feels because of how heavy the topic is and how informative and kind of enlightening it is. So you directed, wrote, and produced this documentary called The S Word, and it's about suicide. And let's talk about it. Tell me what the inspiration was. I don't know if it was your father and brother that you dedicated it to. I assume it was.
Yeah.
So tell me, obviously this is hit home for you. It's hit home for me too. And we'll talk about that. But tell me what the inspiration was behind this film.
Yeah. So when I was a sophomore in college, first my father, then my brother died by suicide within 3 months. Just everything you would think it was. And it wasn't like, I mean, I was a sophomore in college, so I was between 18 and 19, I think. And the idea of doing something like this would never have occurred to me. I mean, I was going through my own grief and everything. Right. And then eventually, I mean, I wrote about it. I wrote stuff and, you know, just dealt with stuff the way I could deal with stuff. And part of it, part of, I guess my process was not really being able to talk about it, especially about my father, because fathers, in my opinion, I didn't know any who had died by suicide. It wasn't a thing, you know. He was my dad. He was my world. It just
and also the timing of when he did it too. I mean, you're in your formative years. You're just learning how to be an adult and something like that. I mean, that makes you grow up super fast, and to have both things happen within 3 months. I mean, I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. The fact that you endured through that is a testament to your character. So I'm sorry you went through it, but you're an amazing person for having gone through it, you know?
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, just cut to several years later when I went to film school, I went to grad school, and I was writing like rom-coms or something. And I'm like, no, this doesn't feel right. I need to be doing something else. And so I did a film on bipolar because it was also something in my family. And in that film, there was somebody who had lost their daughter to suicide. Wow. And so I thought, okay, I've dealt with this and I can move on. And about 10 minutes later, I mean, I realized, no, I have to do something. And that's sort of the, you know, behind, that's what happened with the S word. And I just realized just with the, you know, 10th leading cause of death, everything, there were just a lot of stories out there. And when I went into this, with through the lens of loss, talking to people who had lost people to suicide. And I started talking to people, and I was talking to a lot of people who had attempted suicide and survived. Not that I didn't know that existed. It just wasn't my experience.
Right.
And I realized this is the film I want to make. I want to talk to people who have been to the edge and back.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it's something that we don't talk about. And what's really interesting is one of the things I liked so much about the movie was it put a spotlight on something that is almost taboo to talk about, and it shouldn't be, because it happens so commonly, unfortunately, you know. Right. So some of the statistics you talked about, I think one of them was 44,000 people die every year. Isn't that correct? That's one of the stats.
Yeah, I'm sure it's changed since, but yes. And when we made the film, yeah, I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot. And then attempts, there are a lot of attempts. Transgender youth, much higher.
Right.
It's the second leading cause of death between, I don't quote me, it's because it's been a while, but it's somewhere between like 10 and 28 or something.
I mean, I just saw it. So it said 15 and 24.
15 and 24.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, you think of all the things that can kill people, that shouldn't be one of them, because it's from their own doing. And, you know, personally, I had a saxophonist in my band, and he was the first person, really, it kicked down my door, because he committed suicide when he was on the road with another artist. And it kind of shocked the music world. It shocked all of us in the band, like, because he didn't really talk about it. And so this movie for me, you know, was very poignant, because I've lost family, I've lost friends to this, and it's something that nobody talks about. You can't find any resolution to when you lose somebody in that way, because you're always questioning what you could have done for them, or, you know, like, did you see any signs? Were there any signs? And then there's that whole, like, mental health care, you know, enigma. If people had access to it, if they didn't, if they thought it was expensive, or if it wasn't, or if, you know, there are so many suicide prevention hotlines and groups that now help with this. But I love that you put this spotlight on people that did go to the edge, attempted this, and then came back. What was, like, one of the biggest things that you learned from every person that was maybe a parallel between all of them?
I would say so many things. I mean, so many things. But I will tell you, honestly, the biggest thing, or one of, I should say, is listening. It just is, because it is so easy to give advice, as we all know. It's like, look, if you do yoga and eat quinoa, you're going to feel much better tomorrow, I promise, you know, and all of the advice that we can give somebody. But really, what is needed is listening, and listening without judgment,
right,
without, you know, like, oh, no. And the worst thing is to say, when somebody says to you, and also to ask somebody, are you thinking about suicide? Because it may sound counterintuitive, like, oh, wow, if I bring it up, they're going to do it. Think about that for a minute.
Right.
Like, you're walking along, life is good, and somebody says, you know, whatever, hey, are you thinking about suicide? You know, I wasn't, but now that you mention it, hey, that's a great idea.
Right.
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah,
it works. Right. It's something that they know that they have a safe place to talk. And if you say it, you've opened up the conversation, as opposed to when somebody tells you, you know, I don't want to be here tomorrow. And you say, oh, come on, you're going to feel better tomorrow. Basically, you're taking somebody who's already in a really bad, dark place, and you're diminishing them.
Well, you're not honoring their feelings.
You're not honoring.
And that's, like, the biggest thing. It's like, I think we all want to feel understood on some level. And, like, in that helpless moment, that's, like, the most important time that you want to be understood. And if you're not there with that, it's detrimental. I mean, it's tragic. It is a tragedy. I think it is a tragedy that, you know, there's a lot of great artists that we've lost. One of my favorite songgwriters named Nick Drake. And, you know, I'm sure you know Nick Drake, but he was signed to this label, and the label really wasn't pushing his music, and they were giving him all kinds of excuses, and he just got so depressed and he committed suicide. And then the irony is, now his music is so well known and used in films and well loved and liked over a couple records, and he never got that accolade that he deserved from just, like, how beautiful he was creating, you know, music, you know, how beautifully he was creating it. So it's a lot of it is, like, sometimes you just need someone to listen to or to lean on. Sometimes you need to feel understood. And I think the fact that you showcase this spotlight is tremendous, because there were a couple scenes, like, you know, when you filmed that college laying out all the backpacks, and you just get that perspective, each backpack representing a person that's committed suicide. It's eye-opening when you see how many families and those lives get shattered. You know, it's like, it changes everybody in that nucleus of the family so much. And I've seen it with friends I've lost and family I've lost. So what do you think are some kind of solutions that we can maybe offer that maybe your film is putting a spotlight on, that, you know, some things you were in it just like from getting into the problem. What kind of things did you hear about or did you learn from that are possible solutions?
Solutions are a tough thing, but there are a lot of, so on our website, which I'll give you, and then you can post it. I think it's like yeswordmovie.com or something, has resources and all of this stuff. But as far as solutions, it really is about, I mean, a huge thing is, you know, that whole sort of cliche about nothing heals in the dark, like what you were saying. You got to talk about it. I mean, it's got to be something that we talk about everything. We talk about relationships. Absolutely. We talk about politics. It's like to not talk about something so dark, about like not wanting to wake up the next morning. That is a really, you know, that is a you know, that is something that definitely needs it. And so when you're in talking to somebody, again, it's listening and really listening to what they're saying and what they're feeling, and to honor their feelings, as you were saying, and say, okay, suicide is a solution. Let's think of five others. Let's think of five other things that you could do tomorrow that would not be leaving the world. You know, let's you know, come up with that. I mean, it's a slow process. It takes friends. It takes caring people. It takes, I mean, I don't want to say a village, but I mean, it's definitely a thing. And, you know, as a friend or a loved one to somebody, I mean, that is a huge part of it, is to listen to them, to look for, I mean, yeah, there are signs. There are signs that are listed on a lot of websites, like, you know, somebody feeling like they're giving up. First of all, not to ramble on this, but it is such a complex issue. Like you were talking about Nick Drake. Yeah, I'm sure there was that, but there were five other things probably. Like when somebody blames bullying is horrible. And particularly now with social media, bullying comes home with you, you know? So there are a lot of things. But if you are somebody who has not ever dealt with anything and you're fine and all of that, and then you're being bullied, you've got probably some coping skills. But if you're out of coping mechanisms because of X, Y, Z, and you see this, you know, that could be the final straw. And you talked about, like, you know, believe me, I'll probably go through my whole life with, what did I miss? Why didn't I save it? Why didn't I, you know, and it is futile because you're not going to. However, that can be used for the next person and the next person. That in my case, it was used to make a film about it and to talk to people, to friends, to loved ones who are dealing with this and, you know, hopefully trying to navigate and trying to figure out or see the signs in somebody else who's giving stuff away, who just seems, you know, all of those things that, you know, you try to stay on top of. But on the other hand, as a parent or a child of somebody, you're going to miss something. Right. You know, it is going to happen. It's reality.
That's a natural part of the process, unfortunately. You know, for me, my band member, he was really reserved. Like, he just, like, was to himself. And he was a genius musician. And, you know, we used to share rooms on the road every now and then. And I would tell him, like, man, you're a genius musician. If you ever need someone to talk to, give me a call, man. Because I just knew it wore on him. He was definitely a genius musician. And I know that when you – most geniuses are using more brain power, and it usually isn't to be productive. You know, it's usually, like, beating you down and doing the opposite of what you think is being creative. And I also feel like, you know, taking art out of the schools and giving, you know, less of an outlet for people to kind of like take that energy and make something, that's detrimental too. I mean, you took this trauma and you made something beautiful with it. That's healing, because you made something beautiful with it and took that energy and, you know, turned it into something positive. So I think a lot of that process is lost on the youth and just people, you know, of all ages, because we forget that sometimes that pain can be channeled into something else to create more positivity. And when you don't have the means and activities like around you, it feels like you don't have a life preserver, you know? So right. I think a lot of times artists deal with it just in general. I lost a close friend of mine that did an album cover of mine, and he died of suicide as well. And, you know, it's just one of those things that you can never rationalize, but we always do have to talk about it. And I think one of the taboos, you know, I wanted to ask you about this because I just find it to be curious. Why do you think it is so taboo, or why do you think people feel so judged to talk about it?
It's super vulnerable, of course. And there are a couple things. When it comes to attempts, and they don't want to scare I would much rather have worried and all of that and been able to deal with stuff than to find out afterward.
Right.
Afterward is never better, ever, yeah. ever, ever better.
Yep.
So, but it's feeling like you're in that place and you're going to burden somebody. God, if I tell them, then they're going to worry, and then they're going to watch me, and they're going to, you know, all of the stuff that we know in retrospect. And I can tell you from experience, it just isn't so. I mean, I would much rather be burdened with my father, whatever he was going through, which would not have been a burden, by the way,
right.
Than to have it after the fact. And as somebody who lost somebody to suicide, I can tell you this. When I was in college and with my brother and whatever, I didn't, for the first couple of years, if somebody asked me how my brother died, I would say, and it was all true, in a car and it was snowing.
Wow.
All true. I didn't go through the details because I thought, again, you're at a very vulnerable age and you want to be accepted. And it's like, oh God, they're going to think somebody in my family is, whatever. And also they obviously didn't love me enough to stay around, you know, all of this stuff. So, you know, when our brain is not developed yet and we can't rationalize that, it's easier to just, okay, I'm just gonna kind of obfuscate a little bit.
Right. You know? Well, and the other thing, the silly thing is there is shame that is, you know, attached to it, and there shouldn't be.
There shouldn't be. I mean, because if you say, you know, let's say if you're diabetic and you say, you know what, you call your boss and my insulin is really screwed up. Oh, stay home. Take care of it. Don't worry about it. But if you call your boss and say, I'm really depressed and I can't get out of bed this morning. Oh, come on. Buck up. I'm not saying you're a boss.
Right.
And I think it's gotten.
I'm my own boss, but I say that to myself all the time.
You say that to yourself. Exactly. Exactly. And also in making the film, and you probably noticed that, I mean, it was really, really, really important for us to put a human face on this, because we know the statistics, just like, you know, we see the 44,000 or, you know, however many 22,000 vets, you know,
right.
And, you know, all of this stuff. And, but they're numbers and calculators and things. But when you meet these people and you see their humor was a huge factor too, because you know, we're not going to do a dirge. You know, it's like, oh, this many people died and okay, and then this and then. No, I mean, we've got to see the humanity in these people,
right.
Because, and I don't want to do it as this cautionary tale of it could happen to anybody, but there are a lot of circumstances. There are a lot of things. We just had a pandemic that screwed a lot of people up, you know. Things happen, and it really is about, you know, how we're going to cope. What tools are in our toolbox?
I'm going to give you a huge compliment of something that you did with the movie. And I don't know if this is indirect or direct, but you started with a story that was on one side of the country. And then you started introducing another story that was from Pasadena. One guy was from Massachusetts, and then another guy was from Pasadena. And I grew up in Arcadia, so I'm like 5 miles just east of Pasadena. Yeah. And for some reason for me, and I think, I don't know if you intended to do this with your film, that hit home for me, because seeing the guy in Massachusetts, you're like, oh, maybe it's because of where he lives that he's not around enough people. Or you just think like, oh, maybe it's the geography of the situation, but it's not. And then when you show the Pasadena kid, it's like, oh, this guy grew up in my neighborhood. That hit home for me because it was like, this can happen to anybody in any geographical place, in any neighborhood, in any home. It tears families apart. No one knows why. And the other thing, you know, I had a very close friend. I host the Songwriter in the Round nights. And he was actually going through some mental health problems because he just lost his mom. And he brought up something so insightful. He said, you know, when somebody breaks their arm and they're walking towards a door, anybody's instinct around that person is to open the door and try to help them. But with mental health, it's invisible. You don't see it. And you can't see what a person's struggling through. And so you just assume that because they're going through the motions and they're present, that they're okay, when they can be completely suffering. And that's what I learned the hard way, is people are suffering all the time and going through so much all the time. And I think one of the things a close friend of mine told me, he said, you can't cure people, but the only thing you can do is just try to work on yourself so much that your presence can lighten someone's load around you a little bit. And just be a shoulder and reach out to people. Just like I do little check-ins with my friends where I'll send them a text, just be like, hey guys, are you okay? Is everything cool? What's going on? And it's not enough, but it's, you know, you just think of what we can do possibly to kind of cure this ailment. And, you know, did you intend to do that with the location of people, or did it just so happen that people were on different sides of the country and different walks of life to kind of showcase that it can target anybody?
It was really important to have diversity in a lot of ways. And so, you know, yeah, this person lived here and that person lived here and all of that. I mean, I think that was, it was all intrinsic. It was also important to economic diversity. You know, it's just, you could have all the money in the world and, you know, and feel like, and again, there was like a snippet of, and if you blinked, it would go by really fast, but a snippet of Robin Williams, for example.
Yep.
You were talking about Nick Drake. Robin Williams had it all. It doesn't matter, because you can have it all on the outside, but if you're struggling inside, all of that, none of that matters. Yep. Where you live doesn't matter. What your race or religion or portfolio is, none of it matters. And so it was really important to sort of, you know, show the kind of diversity in that.
That it's amazing. And the fact that you did that, you did it so well and fluidly that, you know, like I was watching it as an observer. And for some reason, because you chose that person from Pasadena and I grew up there, it hit me. I was like, this is almost like a situation that it doesn't choose anybody because of any reason. You know, they think maybe some of it's genetic, but that doesn't matter. None of that matters because we haven't figured out a solution and we're just allowing these things to keep happening. And there isn't enough kind of therapy or counseling or people around, you know, to kind of feel like they can be part of the solution. Do you think that there's some kind of way that these families can kind of link up that have had somebody that they've lost somebody as therapy groups? Is there some kind of program like that where there, you know, where people can reach out because they have that common ground and they've lost somebody? Is there something like some kind
of everywhere? Yeah. And that's a thing too, where again, like, you know, I'm not promoting our website, but we do have those resources. But for example, in like in the LA area, Dee Dee Hirsch has those groups of people who have lost people. What was really difficult and what wasn't happening, and we're hoping it's happening more, are the support groups of people who have attempted suicide and survived, because there was this whole stigma, this whole thing of, well, if they get together, they're going to exchange suicide recipes or something.
Right.
And so there was a concern about that. But In the film, you know, we have somebody who's a photographer and did this whole project, lived through this, and they have a chat group, and they're all talking to each other and stuff. And, you know, it does help when you go to, you talk to people who've been through what you've been through. And so there are a lot of support groups around the country for people who have suffered loss by suicide specifically.
I have an amazing story to tell you that a producer friend told me about recently. He said that he read about this story about this guy who was a suicide attempt survivor, and he went to the Golden Gate Bridge before they had the net underneath. Now, I think that's the number one place that people would go to commit suicide. Now they have a huge net underneath it to prevent that, which is at least good that they have some kind of measure. And he said that he was on this radio show talking about survival after trying to commit suicide. And he said, you know, the radio host asked him, "What do you remember?" And he said, "As soon as I jumped, I had immediate regret," which is something a lot of survivors have. As if they're conscious during the process, right, they have immediate regret. And then he said after, you know, he remembers hitting the water and then literally just, he said he felt sharks rubbing up against him, and that's all he remembers. And then yeah, it took him about 2 or 3 years of getting therapy and healing and getting, you know, medical attention. And when he was on this show, he was on the phone. I mean, he was on the radio show, and somebody called in and said, "I am so filled with joy to hear you talking right now, because I was on the Golden Gate Bridge when you jumped, and I remember seeing you, and you looked troubled, and I remember thinking I should say something to him, and he didn't." And he said, "But there's something that's not correct with your story." And he said, "What do you mean? This is my story." And he said, after you fell, he said, it wasn't sharks that came up and were rubbing up against you. He said a seal that was perched on a rock saw you hit the water, jumped into the water, and was keeping you afloat for 30 minutes until the Coast Guard came. And I was just like so blown away hearing this story, because, you know, one of the things that you had in this movie, you had this dog that was kind of a therapy dog for the movie. And it's like, I think we underestimate how powerful animals can be. And I know you know this because you love your dog like I love my dog. And I feel like some of this therapy may come from things in nature or animals. Do you think that when you were doing that showcase in your film, do you think that there's some connection between animals and people that can be some kind of healing relationship that they had in the movie?
100%. And I do know him, or the person who you're talking to, because we were in a lot of the same spaces, like conventions or speaking engagements and things like that. So yeah, so I know him. And there was a point when maybe he was going to be in the film. And to speak to that, and as far as pets go, and also, well, I'll talk about that in a second, but 100%. I mean, you see a lot of animals in the movie. Yeah. You see like the cat and the dogs and all of that. It is, I know after a hard day when I come home and just hug my dog, I mean, think about it. I mean, that is a family member. And yes, absolutely. And I know how I felt when our dog passed away, you know, and it was, I mean, bereavement of, and that's a kind of bereavement that you can talk about it. And if you're not somebody who loves animals, it's going to be hard for them to understand. It's like, yeah, but it's not your spouse. It's not your brother. It's like, no, it's somebody I was probably with a lot more. You know? and talk about not judgmental, talk about unconditional love. That's
they are.
Where you're going to get
they
it.
Are that. Exactly.
Yeah. So yeah, I do believe that. And I, you know, again, I believe it just from everybody we talk. I mean, we interviewed, you know, the film was, let's say it was 90 minutes. We had 300 hours of footage.
Wow.
And, you know, once we realized, gee, you know, 300 hours, that's long for a movie, wouldn't you think? you know, even if you do it in, you know, like episodically.
Right.
So what we did was something called S-Word Stories, where there were these stories that didn't make make it into the film for whatever reason. And they're, you know, on that website that I'm not promoting as well. So, yeah.
So how did you narrow it down? Like, what stories did you kind of find this needs to be in there versus something that's not?
Hardest part. It was the hardest part. The two things that were so difficult in editing. One, when you were talking about the Pasadena story with Brandon's story, that was about loss. And that was somebody who they had lost their son to suicide. Too close. I mean, as a professional documentary filmmaker, I'm supposed to, and I was crying through the interview.
Oh, man, it was hard.
And trying to, you know, and so when we were in editing, you know, to edit that story with, you know, two people like getting married and figuring things, you know, it's like, how are we going to do this? So that was tough. But it was really about, stories that, again, like Nikki, if you had made the film, you may have had five other people. Like, it was really about where I felt and what I was relating to, because, you know, as much as, you know, somebody might say, God, it was great for you to make that movie and look at what you know, it was great for me because, you know, it was said in the film, Des said it when she was doing her Live Through This project, like, I wasn't looking for a community, but I found one. Yeah. And I wasn't either, but I have to tell you that these people are still my friends.
That's awesome.
I love having that community. And these were people who, we also did a lot of impact screenings too. And there were people who I thought would make, you know, and who people weren't, it was really about relatability, because when people are watching the film, like when you said you really related to Brandon's family, that's important. You have to meet these people and feel something, even if it's just one of them, because if we're going to affect change, and if somebody's going to watch the film and think, okay, well, if I do this and that, you know, maybe this will, you know, they have to relate to somebody. So for us as filmmakers, you know, it was figuring out who we related to, and then showing, you know, we probably had 7, 8, 10 impact screenings, you know, for other people to, you know, people who are not filmmakers.
I want to play the trailer before we forget to do that. So
sure.
Here's the trailer for the S Word.
I remember thinking, God, just hold on, because somehow, some way, this is going to make sense.
The reaction of people around me was just, shut up.
Anybody who has lost anyone through suicide, you always say, what did I miss? Why couldn't I save him?
Suicide. That's a scary word, isn't it?
I just always felt like an alien, like a burden.
I started to look for other people like me, and I couldn't find anything. Like, where were these people?
To say I'm an attempt survivor, even say the word suicide, is a record stopper.
I just want people to look into these people's eyes.
Because we've always looked away. You know, hashtag suicide so white.
My name is Leah Harris, and I am a survivor.
When I'm grumpy, I'm an activist. When I'm nice, I'm an advocate.
It's a project about suicide, but I'm focusing on life.
It's not the word suicide that is the problem. It is the deafening silence around it.
We lose 112 people every day. That's bigger than a small jet airplane.
I'm not doing well. I find myself wanting to hurt myself. I just don't really know how to handle it.
The revolution in mental health is happening, and we are at the forefront.
Is suicide still an option for you?
I don't want it to be.
We're changing a culture.
More and more, it becomes clear to me that I am never alone, that we are never, ever alone.
What would you say to suicide if it was a thing, if it was a person? I'd say, suck it!
This S word, it's only scary if you give it this sort of boogeyman weight.
I used to think, man, maybe life just isn't for everybody. I was done. And I was wrong.
So powerful. I mean, I got to tell you, I watched the trailer first. I just love trailers. I think there's an art to a trailer. Your trailer pulled me in, and then I watched the movie, and it was just like, man, there were so many levels, and you did such a brilliant job of showcasing all the demographics. You have the gay demographic, the black, the Asian, the white, and I don't know if that was intentional, but I think the stories all melted together to be cohesive, to show that this can break apart any family in any household, in any country, in any part of the world at any time. So we have to find a cure for this, you know? So tell me what the one of the shocking things that you kind of discovered just from talking to each of these demographics.
The shocking thing, all of it, talking to these people, particularly Craig, who was at the very beginning with the gas mask, but it was just a photography project of his, but he had he had thought about suicide when he was 8.
Right.
And I would have to say, I mean, there were a lot of things as we were going through this, but thinking about somebody at the age of 8 years old, I mean, some of the stuff that he went through.
Oh, yeah.
And and going through stuff where his parents were right downstairs and things that we hear about, that we read about, that we, you know, but when you're face to face with somebody and they're telling you their shocking story of abuse, and at 8 years old, when you should be on the playground and yep. you're playing with your friends and you're drawing and you're doing all these things and you're taking a kitchen knife. And thinking about that, it's like, no, we have to do something about that. And we can. I mean, we can. But the thing that I really learned doing this, it's a collective responsibility. It's all of us. Just like with homelessness, you know, it's like, it's so easy to point fingers or say, you know, well, this person didn't get the career they wanted. This person didn't have enough money. They got divorced. Somebody died, like all of that stuff. But if we, and I don't want it to sound Pollyannish, but I mean, if we as a community, you know, watch out for our neighbors, for our friends, for our family, you know, just to, because yes, we are going to miss things. As we said before, we're going to miss things, but there are times when we won't miss things, when we'll see that just that little thing like, wow, you're having a bad couple of days, right? What can I do? What can we do together? What can we, you know, go to Encinitas for a couple of days, you know, whatever it is, you know, I mean, can we, again, these things are not cures. They're not solutions. They're not, it's mitigation. You know, it's kicking the can down the road and maybe there'll be something that can help keep somebody here. And all we can do is try and keep trying. And, you know, sometimes it's hard. You know, we get caught up in our own lives. We're busy people. You're doing a radio show. You're in a rock band. You've got all these things. And I don't know if you can hear that. It's my dog barking.
Yeah, I heard it.
Okay.
My dog just came and started scratching at the door.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's real life. But, so that's, you know, we do what we can do. We do what we can do. But it really is, I keep saying it, but it really does come down to humanity, you know, in all its forms, all its shapes. And it's all, you know, you can choose if you want to be a, yeah, I don't know what I can say on this, you know, if I can use a curse word.
Yeah, you can. You can swear all you can say fuck shit, all of it.
okay. I mean, yeah, you can choose if you want to be a dickhead, you know? I mean, if that's what you decide, if you want to be compassionate, if you want to, you know, why not? You know, and when you were talking about the bridge story, there's this whole thing about, wow, if somebody, because there have been people reported from the Golden Gate Bridge, like, God, if somebody had just smiled at me that day,
right?
If this had happened, and again, it's like right before, you know, if somebody's thinking about whatever it is, and it's, you know, if that barista was just kind,
right?
You know, I mean, right. There is something to be said about kindness, you know, because it's just. It's something that we can do.
Spread it around. We got to spread it around like confetti. Yeah. Right? Everyone. Yeah.
I'm not saying it's going to cure. It's not going to solve everything.
No, but it helps.
I got to tell you, it's going to help.
And, you know, I got to thank you for making this movie first, because one thing I think that your film does that is really it's a powerful film, but it is it's a teaching tool, because it shows you things that you're not aware of in the public eye that you know, we know there's a World Suicide Prevention Day, but the actual statistics, we only really hear about on that day. And then when you kind of like print it out and show us in the text and give us, you know, somebody in the trailer and the movie said it's like a full airplane of people going down every day. If that was the case, we'd do something about it. But because this is such a problem that we aren't doing enough of, we kind of turn a blind eye, you're opening the other eye to take a good look hardcore at this problem. And I have to thank you for making this movie, because it was therapeutic to watch it for me, just having lost people, but it also taught me like things to look out for. Just like, I think maybe some of that discussion has to be done in the home, at schools, you know, water cooler talk. It all just has to be a part of it, because I don't think we're all built to just kind of like stay on the hamster wheel and just keep perpetuating, you know, life in the way that we are without there being some drawbacks. So, I mean, what do you think are some ways that maybe we can have open discussions, or kind of like, what could I do, or what can any of our listeners do that may be proactive to kind of just be part of the solution?
Well, part of like what we've done over the last few years, it actually ended. I was touring with the film, which came out in 2017, up until March 9th of 2020. I don't know if you remember 2020.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. I'm sure everybody does. I remember flying home from Canton, Ohio, so out of Cleveland or whatever, thinking something's going on. Should I be wearing a mask? Like, what's happening here? It was just really, it was a thing. But we did universities, we did high schools, we did a couple middle schools, we did a 1 hour version of the film. And what was funny was when we were talking to teachers, because we put together this guide, and which answers, you know, it's got like questions and answers, and if the film goes somewhere where I'm not, because I can't be everywhere, you know, how do we ask questions and answer and all of that. And I remember when we did the film for middle school and stuff, and all the teachers were like, well, make sure you take the F word out of it. And I was thinking, okay, we'll do that, because, you know, most eighth graders have never heard that word, right?
Right,
of course.
Right.
No, not at all. But anyway, we did, because that was a way that we got into some junior highs and stuff like that. So I think it's, you know, if we can, here's the thing, Nikki. I've tried to figure out an elegant way to say this, but it's something that needs to be, the discussion needs to be normalized, so the actual suicide is not normalized.
Right.
So if that makes sense, it's like to be able to
give me chills. That's so great.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because we can talk about, you know, how about those Lakers, you know, whatever it is, and you know, or your relationship, or you know, whatever it may be, my dog. But this is it's so important. And, you know, it's not going to be all the time. It's not going to be, you know, the person, your waiter. Maybe it is, depending on who you are or what you're going through. But it's, just part of the lexicon, part of the conversation, part of the thing. You know, if we can get to a point with it, you know, we can talk about it openly, and the stigma can certainly start to disappear a little bit. Because right. it's a thing. It's something. And it's something that we talk about. It's not something that has to be the S word.
Right. I love that, because it is just perpetuating a good common knowledge and basis and foundation to kind of be aware of, just, you know, kind of listening and being there for people and just trying to normalize talking about it is huge, because this should never, and it always blows my mind, because to me, in my mind, this should never be a normal solution. But the one thing that, you know, Zane, my saxophonist's death, taught me, and also my cousin, you know, went through the same thing. One thing both of their deaths taught me was that in those moments, they felt so alone, even though they were very well loved, had families that were very supportive, had friends that were very supportive and very fun to be around. But in those moments of isolation, they didn't feel like they had any of that. And that's what is, you know, that's the one part that I kind of like find solace in relieving myself of that burden, is I don't blame them. I actually feel like it's an unfortunate way to go, but at least they're not suffering. And I actually offer compassion and don't feel like it is their fault. You know, that's the biggest thing that it kind of taught me, is it's no one's fault that somebody goes through something like this. It's just, I think our responsibility as a community to just try and make sure that nobody feels like they're isolated and left out and like there's no hope, you know? So I think your film does a lot of that. It shows that there's a way out. There's a way to get help. There are hotlines. There are groups that you know, there are people around you without even knowing they're there. They are there. There are therapy groups and therapists that work for free for people that are going through stuff. And a lot of people, you know, do you think the financial means is a big reason why people aren't getting help? Do you think that there's a cloud of, oh, that costs too much, I can't afford it? Because that's something that I was like thinking about during the movie. Like, these solutions, a lot of people don't know they're there. So what do you think about the financial implications, you know, to somebody going through that?
I think I just wanted to go to your point right before that, and then I'll go to that, is because the idea of blame on both sides is so counterproductive. Right. Because when you blame the person, you know, who's dealing with stuff, you know, it's like, yeah, but what about me? You know, why aren't they there? They're not. I mean, you talk about these blinders. If you're in so much pain, the idea of waking up the next morning is impenetrable. I mean, this is the way it's been described to me, is that it's not that I'm thinking about, you know, how it's going to impact you. Right. I can't do this. I can't do this. And then on the other side saying, oh my God, if only I hadn't broken up with him, he'd still be here. It doesn't work that way either. You know, it could be there were 10 things and it could have been one, you know, it could just be, but then once you start blaming yourself for something or going through all of the stuff that goes on that keeps you up at night, it's not going to, it's coming up with ways that you can help the next person as opposed to all of that stuff. And yes, there is absolute financial disparity. There's no question about it. Absolutely. Certain behavioral therapies and stuff like that, diametrical behavior, like DBT, which is supposedly just the gold standard, is super expensive.
Right.
Are there places that do it? Probably. Again, I can't speak to where it is right now because I'll misspeak and I don't know 100%, like where, and CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, a lot of therapists work on sliding scales. A lot of them do. And it does exist out there. And there's a lot of controversy about medication, yeah, about psychiatric hospitals, and if somebody and when somebody's under 18, forced care. So I would, that is so up to the individual and the families. So that's another difficult thing to speak to. But I know that if somebody wants to get their child to, you know, let's say a 15-year-old, and there are no beds, you know, but if you have a lot of money, you have a lot of resources, you'll probably be able to find a bed. But at a county hospital, there's a very good chance that there are no beds. So 100, absolutely, there is financial despair. It's like every single other thing in the world, where if you've got the money, but the one thing that it does not do is, if you've got the money, are you going to necessarily survive because you're rich and you have this, this, and this resource? Not necessarily, not if you're struggling to that extent, but it does help it. But if you're really poor and you can't get the help that you need, that sucks. And that is not fair. And there is no, and the other thing is, when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to insurance company, is parity, is mental health and physical health parity. Yeah. The fact that it's like, you know, with something like the Affordable Care Act, where he tried, Obama certainly tried to, but it's like, you know, yeah, no, we'll help if you've had cardiac, you know, if you've had heart problems, but I don't know that we're going to pay for your psychiatric meds. You know, I don't know that we can pay for that, because that's something that it's in your head, right, you know, as opposed to understanding the mind body. And that's, you know, again, I don't want to take, but the idea when somebody says, well, that's psychosomatic, you know, that's all in your head. Okay. So what?
Right.
It's somewhere. You're still feeling a certain way. You're still diminishing my feelings. Yep. So that doesn't seem to be really good. Yeah. Right?
What do you think is, all those things were super valid points, by the way, and some I wasn't even thinking of. So thank you for putting a spotlight on those as well. What was your biggest obstacle in making the film? Was it that it hit so close to home? Was it, there were so many stories and you had to narrow it down? Was it just like trying to find the narrative and what you wanted to say? What was the hardest or the biggest obstacle that you went through?
Everything you said. yes, it was very close to home, and editing was definitely a thing. So many stories, so many were good, and really trying to find that balance and trying to figure out what our through line was. Also, it's so big. And after we made the, it's like, you can do a sequel? Are you going to show where they are now? Or are you going to do something on youth? I want to do something on youth, yeah, suicide. And that's, yeah, a huge obstacle, because if you think about it, and how many parents are going to give an okay for a 15-year-old to talk about their suicide because they're feeling shame. So yeah, that is something that I've interviewed people, I've talked to people about this, and that could be absolutely huge. So I think, you know, I think those things for sure, coming up with the stories and the best stories. But I'll tell you something that was not an obstacle that I was afraid of, was people opening up. And wow, I think part of it was, again, it's not like you show up at somebody's door with a big camera rig and say, hey, tell me about your suicide. Hey, you want to talk to me about, you know, people you've loved? It doesn't work that way. So you open up, you start, and you're talking to them without the camera. And then this film took 4 years, I think, altogether. 3 to 5 years. Yeah, I think it was like 4.5 years to make the film. You know, a year of research and then talking to people, following them for 3 years, the 3 years of production, of like literally like following them and following their stories and stuff. And also realizing that it is not me asking questions, then them answering questions, and then their monologue. It's very much a dialogue, and it's building trust and all of that. And would it be the same again? It would be a different film if you made it than if I made it. And you are very good at opening people up and all of that. I had the unfortunate it's the club where nobody wants to be a member. Right. And so there was that kind of trust that.
Yeah, and you almost have to disarm them, which is so hard to do with such a taboo subject matter, you know?
Right.
Especially, you know, what hit home was the Asian family hit home to me because the Asian families, and I know this from just from being East Indian, generally, we don't talk about emotions like that. We don't talk about things that like suicide. So, it you know, to see that family open up, that was a very triumphant moment for your film, for me, because I know that's not common in the culture. You know what I mean? So, so tell me how you went about it that made it easier to do so.
That was tough, and that was really about relatability. I mean, when I met Gene and when I met Brandon's sister, Shauna, too, those things, I mean, interviewing Shauna, talking to Shauna was very close.
Right.
I mean, because I related, again, every story is different,
right.
And her brother was different than my brother and all of that, but oh my God, it was just very, very close. And in talking to them and in talking to Jean, and then she asked me questions about my father. She asked me questions about my brother and us crying together.
Wow.
You know, again, I don't recommend crying when you're, you know, trying to do a job. I'm not telling people to, yeah, go and go cry.
No, it's good for it. It's good for the process.
Yeah, just break down and just be totally vulnerable and be totally unprofessional. That's a great way to go about your job. I'm not recommending that, but it happened to be the circumstance. I wasn't like, but I was, it was emotional. And we were talking on that level. And that was really what that became. And then talking, and Shauna, you know, it was the first time, like, Jean has become an advocate. Like, she was doing the 900. She was doing all kinds of stuff. And she works at Dee Dee Hirsch and all of that. And Shauna, his sister, is becoming an art therapist, which is something that he wanted to become, a music therapist. And so maybe she's becoming a music therapist, or maybe she's already, it's already happened. And so, and talking to her, and she was, you know, definitely talking to sister was right. Something that really got her to, you know, to trust. But it wasn't the first meeting necessarily. It took a little while, you know, and
well, that's the comfort level, just like you opening up, you know, for the film.
Absolutely. You gotta be, yeah, you know, because if it's all give and no take, or all take and no give, or however it goes, it's not gonna work, I don't think.
Well, Lisa, I want to thank you personally for making this movie, because it was therapeutic to watch it, and I know it's going to open a lot of eyes and minds and hearts. Where can people find you? Where can people find this movie if they want to watch it?
It's on Amazon Prime, and it was on Doc Plus. It's on, I'll send you the website too, because there's also the educational version.
Okay.
Which is great for colleges, universities, mental health organizations, and stuff like that. And that is Good Docs. It's called Good Docs. And it's probably like gooddocs.com. All of this is on the website, which is the swordmovie.com.
And where can people find you?
And that's where they would probably find me, since I'm not a big, I mean, well, our presence, we have a Facebook page, which is theswordmovie.com, or might be, yeah, an Instagram at Suadoc is our Instagram. And same with Facebook. Twitter might be at Suadoc as well. I should have been prepared for all the social media stuff. So we will send you all that.
That's okay. You can send that on the site.
Yeah, but, so you can put all that on the side.
Lisa, you made an amazing movie, and I hope you continue to make movies with this subject in mind, because it's something that we should always be talking about. It's educating the general public, and it's opening our minds and hearts. And thank you so much for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. We're going to have you back. So we're going to have you back in about 9 or 10 months, and we'll talk about this movie or more movies that you're working on, because I know you and your husband, Doug, are always working on movies. And you know what?
We just want
to... The whole point of this show is to open up the story of your career as an artist, and we want to showcase your movies, and we think you're a tremendous artist. So thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood.
Thank you so much for having me, Nikki. You're great at your job.
No problem. Okay, I'll keep my day job then. Thank you so much, Lisa.
All right, take care.
For me, on behalf of Sam, myself, and Lisa, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, If anybody needs help, there is a suicide prevention line. I don't know the number off, but just Google it. It's within your fingertips. The solution is always within
your fingertips. I think it's 988.
Okay, 988. There you go. Much love, peace, love. Take care of yourself. Good time. We'll see you guys next.
Listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kourula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA.